When it comes to Avdiivka, there is an article in Bloomberg that war in Ukraine is turning in Putin's favor. Did we have stalemate in Ukraine, in your opinion?
You know, their whole point is to stir up trouble in a presidential political cycle. This war has never been stalemated. Ukraine was never going to win this war. Ukraine never had a chance to win this war. The outcome was always preordained to a Russian victory. All the West has done is funnel in more resources that continued Ukraine's suffering. Ukraine was never capable of beating Russia, ever. We don't need Bloomberg to tell us this. I mean, here's my problem with the Western audience. Are you prisoners to Bloomberg? Are you prisoners to the Wall Street Journal? Are you prisoners to the New York Times? Are you prisoners to the Washington Post? Don't you know how to think? Engage your damn brains. Look at the data. You don't even need me to tell you what it is. It's so obvious. It's like the nose on your face. Ukraine was never going to win this war. There was never a chance of Ukraine winning this war. And all this, the fact that so many people bought into this notion, because where was Bloomberg 6 months ago? Were they calling it a stalemate? Or was Bloomberg saying Ukrainian victory is inevitable? The counteroffensive will succeed. Russia is weak. Russia can't produce missiles. Russian leadership is corrupt. Putin is dying. Navalny is God. This is stupidity in the extreme. Bloomberg is a non-existent non-entity. It's a Western mainstream media that doesn't exist to inform people. It exists to serve their political masters. And right now, we're in a presidential election cycle. Everybody needs to understand that all the media coming to you from Western sources isn't designed to inform you, but to stir up emotions in a manner that influences how you will vote come November. That's it.
When you look at the battle in Avdiivka and you see the suffering that Ukrainians had, and you see Zelensky coming out in an interview with Fox News talking about that nobody needs Avdiivka. If that was the case, why they were sacrificing too much in Avdiivka?
Clearly, within Ukraine, there's two schools of thought. One school of thought is that we have to fight for every square inch. We have to show the West that we won't surrender, that their investments are not in vain. The other school of thought is we have limited resources. We should not sacrifice these resources needlessly, that we should pull back, shorten our lines, consolidate our reserves, things of that nature. Zelensky is of the former. He was hold on to every square inch, attack, attack, attack. But now when confronted with the disaster of that decision, he seeks to spin it away. Zelensky has never cared about a single Ukrainian soldier. If he had, he would have made peace back in March, April of 2022. But he's shown that he doesn't care about Ukrainian soldiers or the Ukrainian people. He only cares about Zelensky. Zelensky's status as, because to continue this conflict, he was elevated to the modern day Winston Churchill. I mean, Zelensky is the ultimate narcissist. He was told that he's somebody great. He's a historical figure. And now he must have Ukrainian men, Ukrainian women in increasing numbers, die to sustain this fiction that has been created by, once again, the Western mainstream media.
The German finance minister recently said that they're having a lot of difficulties in maintaining 2% of their GDP for the defense budget. And at the same time, you see they're trying to escalate the situation in Ukraine.
Talk is cheap. There's a lot of talk. But putting action behind the words, that's where it gets expensive. And the observations of the German finance minister are apt. Germany's economy is in the tanks. Porsche is shutting down its manufacturing plant in Germany and taking it to the United States. Other industries have done the same. There is no heavy industry in Germany anymore. It's collapsing as we speak. It's deindustrializing in front of us. A deindustrialized Germany with an economy in recession is in no position to allocate 2% of gross domestic product or more to military adventures. Nobody in Europe is in a position to do this. I feel sorry for the Swedish people because by joining NATO, they have bankrupted themselves. They've guaranteed themselves to be in decades of economic decline because they will be called upon to invest into a military machine that cannot succeed in what NATO claims that it wants to do, strategically defeat Russia. We see, you know, Emmanuel Macron convening this pathetic meeting where he has talked about nations entering into security relationships with Europe where they can deploy their forces on a unilateral basis, not part of NATO. Nobody wants to sign that suicide pact. I mean, France is saying, all right, who wants to go first? Because it ain't going to be France that goes first. France will never do it alone because France doesn't have the courage nor the capacity to do this. NATO is a fundamentally broken organization. History will show that this Ukraine conflict, rather than empowering NATO, is what destroyed NATO. NATO's on the way out. It'll take years, but NATO is done. The sinecure that has been NATO for so many Europeans, this job market, this money laundering scheme, is no longer viable and no longer sustainable. And that's just the reality of it.
When you look at the current situation of their military, the European military, I'm not talking about the United States, how capable are they?
They have no capability whatsoever. If you take the United States away, Europe can't do anything. Their equipment is pathetically overcomplicated and under-maintained. Their armies are notoriously unprepared for war. They can't sustain a military exercise, let alone a military conflict. And their economies now, because of their decision to sanction Russia and the boomerang effect that it's had on them, their economies cannot sustain militarization. Europe is a joke. It's a pathetic joke. They have weapons. Weapons are dangerous. They've provided weapons to Ukraine. It's not changed the outcome. It just guarantees that more Ukrainians die. But the Europeans aren't prepared for a conflict. The British army won't fill a soccer stadium. The French army is, you know, maybe pretty good on parades, but they can't fight. The German army, let's just forget about the German army. They don't exist. The Italians, no. Where's an army in Europe? Show me an army in Europe capable of fighting. The Baltics, look, they're, I don't even want to insult Chihuahuas because Chihuahuas have more heart and more capability than the Baltic armies. The Polish army, you know, it's like pumping up a balloon. You know, oh, look how big we are. Pop, you're done. There is no military capability in Europe, none. Now, people talk about the combined capacity of Europe. How do you get this combined capacity? How do you get Spanish divisions over to Poland? How do you get Portuguese divisions to Poland? How do you get Italian divisions to Poland? How do you get French divisions to Poland? You know, half of NATO is on the other side of Europe. It ain't going to deploy to Poland. So let's stop talking about combined capacity. NATO is not a threat militarily to anyone but NATO, because there are members of NATO who think that they are what they proclaim themselves to be, a viable military alliance. NATO is a joke. But fortunately, this joke has lost its punchline. The laugh track is gone. And I think in a decade or so, NATO will no longer exist.
We had this interview of Tucker Carlson. When this interview started, Putin went to great length to describe the history of Russia, of that region. In your opinion, what was the necessity of that?
Because this is what Vladimir Putin does. See, Tucker Carlson should have been prepared. Vladimir Putin has been doing this from the very beginning, back in 2007, back in 2014, 2017, 2018, 2021, 2022. Every time he talks about the Ukrainian situation, he grounds it in history because it's important. History is important to understand where the Russians are coming from. But Tucker Carlson rolled his eyes because he doesn't care. And frankly speaking, those in the West who ask questions like yours, and I'm not picking on you, you're asking a question, I'm not blaming you for the question, but it just shows the underlying ignorance of the West. History matters. And if you don't understand the history, then you don't understand why Russia is doing what it's doing. And therefore, you will be taken by surprise because people say, well, there's no reason for Russia to do this. There's every reason for Russia to do this in the minds of the Russian people, in the minds of Russian leadership. Tucker Carlson should have shut up, stop asking stupid questions, stop intervening, and listen to what the president said. He should have done the reading before he went into that interview to understand. Look, nothing President Putin said in that historical introduction was new. He has said it before, almost word for word. He has it memorized because it's his history. Had Tucker Carlson done his job, he would have, you know, taken apart earlier statements and found the point to ask a relevant follow-up question. to anticipate what the president's going to say, ask a question, and as a good interviewer, throw your target off balance. You see, Putin was throwing Tucker off balance by coming in with the history. Tucker was thrown back. He was no longer in control of the interview. Putin was in control. Interviews are a game between the interviewer and the interviewee. Tucker Carlson was knocked on his back feet from the start and never recovered. Never recovered. If he was a good interviewer, he would have anticipated what Putin does because Putin always starts off with the history. And he would have asked relevant follow-on questions to show Putin that he knows the topic, that he can anticipate the next statement, and that he's throwing a curveball in. You pick an aspect of history that Putin hasn't discussed in public before, throw it in there, forcing Putin to deviate from his script, go back into his internal knowledge, and come forth with something new. And maybe because you've asked the question, you've anticipated the answers, and you have follow-on questions to the follow-on question, and now you're in control of the interview. Tucker Carlson lost control of the interview. People who looked at that and said that's just a historical statement have no clue what they're talking about. Look, I used to do interviews, well, we'll call them interrogations, for a living. I spent 7 years interrogating the hell out of Iraqi officials. You don't think I walked into each one of these interrogations prepared to the hilt? You don't think I studied these people? You don't think I studied the topics? You don't think that I organized my questions so that I was leading them to an answer that I knew they would give me that was a lie so I could hit them with a counter question, throw them off, and get them to admit the whole thing's a lie? Who was in charge of that interview, them or me? I was every single time. Tucker Carlson should have been in charge of this interview. Now, it would have been a difficult thing to do. Putin's a good counterpuncher. He is, after all, the president of Russia. He knows Russia better than Tucker Carlson would. But with a little bit of preparation, Tucker Carlson could have guided this interview in a direction. And Putin said afterwards, I wish Carlson was better prepared. I was expecting better questions. I was disappointed by this. You don't have to worry. If Vladimir Putin, who is the president of Russia, says, I want to be interviewed, he's saying, I want to participate in this game. He's not saying, I want to, you know, have a monologue. He's saying, bring it on, bring it on. And if you can't bring it on, he will embarrass you. There have been successive Western journalists who have tried to enter the ring with Vladimir Putin only to be beaten down because they weren't prepared, because they were coming at it with traditional, predictable Western questions, and Putin knew what they were going to ask and had the answer. But if you came in prepared, if you studied Putin, if you studied Russian history, and you knew the facts, you could ask relevant follow-on questions. Putin would have loved that. He would have loved them. He's a judo practitioner. He loves to give and take. Grab him, throw him. He grabs you, he throws you. That's the kind of interview he wants, as long as it's respectful. You don't disrespect the man. But an intelligent question is not disrespectful. It's actually the most respectful thing you can do. You say, I respect you as the leader of Russia. I respect you as a man who knows Russian history. Therefore, here's a relevant question. And Putin would have said, wow. Tucker Carlson prepared. He asked a question. I have an answer. Now I have to be on guard because what's Tucker Carlson going to say next? You see, you've thrown Putin off a little bit. Putin's now guessing what's going on here. And now they start dancing. And it's a beautiful thing to behold. That wasn't the purpose of the interview, though. Tucker Carlson wasn't there to have an interview of substance. This was a marketing ploy. And I'm not saying that negatively. It was important that Tucker Carlson have this interview to break the ice, to expose Vladimir Putin to a Western audience, to an audience outside of Russia, over 1 billion views. So this was a tremendous success, and people got to hear the Russian president for the first time. And if they have inquiring minds, they would start to Google this, and they would find out what I just told you. Well, this isn't the first time Putin has said this. Fact is, there was hardly anything new in this interview. Some revelations about Evan Gershkovich and negotiations, but there was nothing new in this interview, except the fact that people got to hear Putin speak. They got to see his facial expressions, see his body language, identify him as a human, as an intelligent human. They brought him to life, which is what the West didn't want to do. The West wants to portray Vladimir Putin as this evil dictator, this, you know, Voldemort-type figure, you know, sitting up in Mordor, looking over in an evil fashion. Instead, he appeared as a human. An intelligent human, a leader, but a human nonetheless. That's why the West didn't want this interview to take place. That's why this interview was a tremendous success, and Tucker Carlson deserves all the credit in the world for doing this. But I'm just saying that, you know, you asked the question about Russian history. If you have to ask the question, it means you don't understand what was going on there. and I'm not picking on you. You're asking the question to educate people. But for all the people out there saying, why did Putin do that? It means you don't know anything about Putin, about how Putin operates, about Russian history, and why it's relevant.
One of the things that Putin said during this interview, when it came to the mercenaries in Ukraine, he said the first country is Poland, the second is United States, and the third is Georgia. Did you know that we have a lot of Americans in Ukraine in the second place? That was shocking for me.
Why was it shocking to you? Of course, we know there's lots of Americans. They're idiots. They go on TikTok. They go on Facebook. They go on Twitter. They flood the social media with their presence, and they die in droves. Of course, we know there's a large number of Americans in there. The Russians have been saying this for some time now. Listen to the Russian commanders about the amount of English being spoken on Ukrainian military nets in combat. They know this. They see the dead bodies. It didn't take me by surprise at all.
When it comes to the mercenaries, how much they have influenced this conflict in Ukraine? What was the outcome for the West?
Look, is there anything good coming out of it? Yeah, dead mercenaries. Dead mercenaries are always a good thing. I hate to be callous that way, but a mercenary is the scum of the earth. You're being paid to kill somebody not in support of your nation. Don't tell me about the cause. It was about the cause you'd volunteer. But you're taking money to go and kill Russians in this case. So you're the scum of the earth. You stand for nothing. You don't stand for America. Take the damn flag off your shoulder. Stop pretending that you're American. Burn your passport because you're the scum of the earth. You take money to kill people. Okay, you're a murderer. That's it. Just a murderous scum. So what good comes out of mercenaries going to Ukraine? That they die. That's what's good about it. And hopefully they die in large numbers, huge quantities. But, you know, this isn't a cause like we saw with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade during the Spanish Civil War, where Americans went over to fight for a cause they believed in. What is the Ukrainian cause? If it's anti-Russian, then it's not a Ukrainian cause. That just means that you're prejudiced against Russians and you just want to kill Russians, and you'd kill Russians wherever you could. Do you support Banderism? Are you a racist? Are you a Nazi? Well, then again, that goes in line with the kind of mental capacity that's required to be a mercenary. It means you're not a human being. You're scum. I hope you die soon. This isn't a cause. This isn't something to rally around. Did they have an impact? I think in the summer of 2022, they did have an impact. They stepped in at a time when the Ukrainian army had been eviscerated by the Russians. You know, everybody does. You know, everybody talks about the peace negotiations. Why do you think Ukraine went to the peace table so early on? Because the Russians were destroying their army, wiping them out. Yes, the Ukrainians were doing a flexible defense. Yes, Russian forces penetrated too deep sometimes without adequate security. Convoys were cut off and killed. But the Ukrainians were being wiped off the map. Talk to the Ukrainian soldiers about May, June, and the desperate straits they were in. It was only the injection of $48 billion of U.S. military aid and a couple billion dollars from the Europeans, and the arrival of tens of thousands of mercenaries who were able to form units that were able to be deployed on the battlefield and used in support of this operation, this counteroffensive, along with other Ukrainian units. But the mercenaries took the lead in this counteroffensive. Now, they all died, and so did the Ukrainian army. That's why they had to rebuild them. But now it became positional warfare, and mercenaries started to realize that war is hell. It's not a lark. It's not a game. Getting hit by Russian artillery over and over and over again with no hope of surviving became something that fewer mercenaries wanted to participate in. And today, I think you see there's fewer mercenaries on the battlefield. They are deployed in areas where you have Ukrainian nationalist units, Azov Battalion, the Nazis, because they are like-minded. They're criminal elements. But fewer and fewer people are willing to go off and volunteer, sign up for what is, in all essence, a death sentence. But no, mercenaries haven't had a meaningful impact on this battlefield except extending the conflict. And the only thing good about it, as I said before, is that for every mercenary that signs up, hopefully that's just one more dead mercenary. The world doesn't need mercenaries. The world doesn't need mercenaries. The world should condemn mercenaries. Nobody should weep over the death of a mercenary because They are people without a state. They have said, I am not. I mean, I get tired of saying a Brazilian mercenary. Really? A Brazilian mercenary? He's not a Brazilian. He's a mercenary. He's taking money to kill Russians. Is that the official policy of Brazil? Then send your own troops who took an oath to Brazil saying we are defending Brazil's interests by going to Ukraine and fighting the Russians. But don't call them a Brazilian mercenary. They're stateless. They don't belong to Brazil anymore. They're the scum of the earth. Don't call them American mercenaries. They're stateless. They're not Americans. Americans take an oath to their country, wear the flag, get paid by the American taxpayer, support the Constitution. You don't go over there as an individual to get paid to wage war on behalf of a non-American entity like Ukraine, especially one that has embraced the ideology of Stepan Bandera. Mercenaries have no state. They're stateless scum. And when they die, nobody should shed a tear.
Stoltenberg just recently said that in the memory of Navalny, they're going to send more aid to Ukraine. It's so amazing, this combination of these two cases. It seems that the West and NATO is hoping some sort of stalemate in Ukraine, because it seems the end game for them would be a stalemate in Ukraine, that Russia would suffer forever. Do you see that coming to Ukraine?
If you're a boxer and you're in the ring with Mike Tyson during his prime, I'm sure sometime around the third round, maybe a minute into the third round, as Tyson's picking you apart, punching you, you're sitting there saying, oh, I hope this round ends. I hope for a stalemate. I hope for some. No, you're going to get knocked out. You're in the ring with Mike Tyson. And Mike Tyson's beating the crap out of you. He just spent two rounds studying, learning you. Now he's bringing the pain. Ukraine's in the ring with Mike Tyson. And they're feeling the pain. NATO's there symbolically. They're the trainer on the sideline watching their fighter get taken apart. Again, the trainer can sit there and say, well, the best I can hope for is that maybe Mike Tyson breaks his hand punching my guy, and then he can't finish the fight and we have a draw. That ain't going to happen. Mike Tyson's going to knock your boy out. Your boy's getting knocked out as you speak. There will be no draw. For all the people that are hoping for a draw, do you really think that's a draw? Do you think Russia's ever been willing to accept a draw? No. This war ends when Russia determines the war is over. And I'm telling you right now, increasingly the signs are this war will not end until Odessa is Russian, Mykolaiv is Russian, Dnepropetrovsk is Russian, Kharkiv is Russian, maybe more if Ukraine wants to continue this insanity. Ukraine's going to lose easily 20% more of its territory and the population that resides there, because they're listening to their NATO trainer who told them to get back into the ring.
We know that there are some problems at the border with Poland, between Ukraine and Poland. If they lose Odessa and they lose their access to the Black Sea, what would happen to Ukraine?
I don't care. I don't care. Ukraine can go to hell as far as I'm concerned. I used to care. I used to say, you know, pity Ukraine, poor Ukraine. But Ukraine right now has allowed themselves to be captured by insane people. So at this point in time, I don't care anymore. I'm not going to waste time worrying about the Ukrainian people or the Ukrainian nation when they don't worry about themselves. If they were concerned about their grain, then they should have understood the importance of Black Sea access, and they would never have allowed NATO to use Odessa as a launching pad to strike Crimea and strike the Black Sea fleet. For all those Ukrainian heroes, keyboard heroes, are like, yay, another Russian ship sunk. Yay, another Russian ship sunk. You know, every time you tweeted that, you guaranteed that Odessa will be Russian. And that's the end of it, the end of your fantasy. It's over. I don't care. Russia will resolve the Ukrainian question the way Russia sees fit. But I'm not wasting any more time on Ukraine. I don't care, because every time I cared for them, they disappointed me. Why should I care about a people that don't care about themselves? Why should I worry about the fate of the Ukrainian farmer when the Ukrainian government doesn't care about the fate of the Ukrainian farmer? Why should I worry about the citizens of Western Ukraine when the Ukrainian government doesn't care about them? It's not my job to do the Ukrainian government's job. It's not my job to do Europe's job. You know, Europe doesn't care about the Ukrainians. They're abandoning them as they speak. So what, I'm supposed to invest all of my emotions into caring about a people that don't care about themselves? I used to cry, you know, at the end of each week about what's happening in Ukraine. There's no more tears for Ukraine. No more tears for Ukraine. Russia needs to finish this job, and then Russia will decide what the fate of Ukraine is. All I can say for the Ukrainian people is look at how the Russians were willing to work with the Chechens and come up with an equitable solution for the conflicts that they fought there. Chechnya today thrives. They have their own language, their own religion, their own culture. They get along great with the Russians. That could be Ukraine's future, but I don't care. That's a Russian problem now. But for the Ukrainian people, for the Ukrainian army, for the Ukrainian farmer, no more tears for me. I just don't care because they don't care about themselves.
The other thing that Putin said during this interview was they have to denazify Ukraine. And denazification in the eyes of Putin was all about the law in the constitution of Ukraine. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, let's just start off. It's not in the eyes of Putin. Putin is a Russian president. He's the executive of the Russian nation. So say in the eyes of the Russian government, or you can even say in the eyes of the Russian people, the Russian nation. I think it's wrong to personify this and say that Putin is the one. He of course, was the mouthpiece. He was the voice that you heard. But when Putin speaks, he's not speaking as Putin. He's speaking as the leader of Russia, the Russian government, the Russian people. And if you understand that, then you understand how strongly your next words resonate, that it's about law. Russia is a nation of laws. This isn't about individual retribution. This isn't about personal revenge. This isn't about Vladimir Putin having a grudge against somebody. This is about the Russian nation, a nation whose history and heritage says that the existence of a Nazi regime in Ukraine is not only a historical affront, but it cannot be allowed to exist. It represents an existential question of survival, not just for Russia, but for the entire world. This is an evil that should have been stamped out in 1945, never to raise its head again. But here it is, fostered by the West. So there will be denazification. Morally, it has to happen. The ideology of Stepan Bandera can never again be allowed to resonate forth from Ukrainian soil. It may exist in diaspora, in Canada, here in the United States, as I've said over and over again, in Ellenville, they have a statue to this scum of the earth, Stepan Bandera and his compatriots. So his memory may live on. They're just like racism today lives on in the homes of the few Ku Klux Klan members who hide amongst society. But we don't tolerate the racism here. It exists, but we don't officially tolerate it. Russia's not going to tolerate the continuation of this. Banderism must be eradicated legally. It must be made illegal. There must be changes in the Ukrainian constitution that ban this, that outlaw, just like the Germans did with Adolf Hitler, outlaw statues, outlaw commemorations. How many Adolf Hitler Strasses do you see? Has Berlin turned their main street into Adolf Hitler Strasse? No. Why? It's illegal. In Nuremberg, have they resurrected a statue of Adolf Hitler where people come in and lay flowers every year to commemorate his death? No. Why? It's illegal. Why? Because the Germans have decided that Adolf Hitler's ideology, the Nazi ideology, is not tolerable. It's incompatible with Germany, and they've outlawed it. And that's the future of Ukraine. Ukraine will have to pass laws, will have to pass a constitution that says that Banderism is outlawed, not tolerated. And if the current makeup of Ukrainian government doesn't want to do that, then Russia will find one that will. And that's how you denazify. You terminate the current government that has breathed life into Banderist ideology, and you replace it with a government that will make the changes necessary to outlaw and condemn and eradicate Banderism. That's denazification. Plus, you hunt down and kill everybody in the right sector in Sloboda and the other neo-Nazi Azov who have committed these horrible crimes. Now, Russia won't kill them because Russia, of course, is a law-abiding nation, has done away with the death penalty. But they will arrest them. They will put them on trial. And if they're found guilty, they will pay the requisite penalty, probably, 2+ decades in prison. But that's the lot of criminals. You break the law, you pay the price. I mean, as my old buddy Beretta said, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime.
Putin said that in the eyes of the U.S. elites, China is the biggest enemy of the U.S. In your opinion, if that's the case, why they started this war with Russia in Ukraine if China is the biggest enemy of the United States in the eyes of the U.S. elites?
Well, first of all, Putin's 100% correct. And one of the U.S. elites who reflects the notion that China's the biggest threat is Tucker Carlson, who views China as a bigger threat than Russia. So Putin was simply calling Tucker Carlson out on, you know, on his own ideology. The way the United States squares this problem is by saying that Russia is little more than a military power, that when you eliminate the Russian army and you stop focusing on Russian nuclear weapons, there is no Russia from the standpoint of these American experts. It's, as they said, a gas station masquerading as a nation. Now, this is as ignorant as the day is long. This is why I always tell people, look, if you're a reporter, if you're somebody who follows geopolitics and economics, you belong at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum in June. It's the most important economic forum out there. It swamps Davos in terms of relevance. Davos is just a bunch of stupid rich people fantasizing about a world that doesn't exist. The St. Petersburg International Economic Forum is about reality. It's where Russia is making linkage with the rest of the world, and that linkage is succeeding, including China, including India, including others. The other place you need to be this year is in Kazan in October, when Russia hosts the BRICS summit, and you're going to see a transformation of geopolitical reality. This is real. And Russia is a leader in both of these efforts. So I think the people who say that, Russia is nothing, they don't know Russia, but Russia doesn't care. That's the beauty of it anymore. Russia is going to hold the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, and with or without you. The BRICS summit is going to happen with or without the West, and it's going to be a success regardless of what the West does. But the West dismisses Russia, and they focus on China because they focus on, China's growing economic clout. The West doesn't talk about a military confrontation with China. They talk about, this economic conflict. And they don't like to say that we're against China. We just want to de-risk ourselves. We don't want to be prisoner to Chinese-controlled supply chains, et cetera. But we don't have a counter-strategy. One thing I point out about China is that they've had, since I think around 2013, something called the Belt and Roads Initiative, where they've poured in $7 to $10 trillion, that's with a T, $1 trillion into global infrastructure development. The United States, in comparison, has no counterpart. And what we've tried to produce, we measure in terms of hundreds of billions of dollars, but it doesn't come close to what the Chinese have done. We are so far behind the power curve on this one, it's not funny, and we can't catch up. So what we try to do, and we also recognize that if Russia and China make common cause economically, that we're sort of in a bind. So we're trying to drive a divide between Russia and China. And in some ways, you could see that Tucker Carlson was trying to do that as well, trying to promote to Putin the idea that China was a problem, something to be feared. And Putin countered that by saying, no, we don't buy into that. China's our neighbor. You don't get to pick your neighbors. So China's a reality that we have to live with and prosper with. And so we do that. You don't need, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to point out the differences between Russia and China. But what Russia and China have decided is to not allow those differences to serve as an entree for people who want to pry them apart. They're coming together largely because of the policies of the West. But the West, we were arrogant, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, to say that we were the world's, sole remaining superpower, that there was no power capable of standing up to us militarily. So we just assumed military supremacy, and we viewed every other problem as being economic and, economically related geopolitical problems. So we discounted the potential of somebody standing up militarily. Russia has surprised everybody by what's happened in the last 2 years. And it's causing the West to realize that this gas station disguised as a nation that has this very large and capable military, has to be considered. But one of the ways they're trying to focus on Russia right now is to drive a wedge between Russia and China. And Tucker Carlson was trying to do that. And you see everybody in the West is trying to do that today as well. But it's not going to work. BRICS. Spell it out, baby. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Now we can add Egypt. We can add Iran, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, United Arab Emirates. What's not in there? Europe or the United States. They're not part of BRICS. Maybe they will be in the future, but not now, because BRICS is the counter to the G7, to NATO, to an American unipolar world.
How do you see this war in Ukraine influencing the China's point of view on the geopolitical issues? Because they cut a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It worked out for them in terms of this conflict in the Black Sea. China before that was mostly focused on their economy. Right now, it seems that they're changing their attitude. Do you see this changing coming for China more and more?
Well, I do see China asserting, trying to capitalize on its economic strengths to become a more relevant player in terms of, you know, geopolitics, global geopolitics. You know, what China's not going to do is replace the United States as a military hegemon. You're not going to see Chinese fleets sailing around the world threatening to bomb people. China's about economic development, about good relations, normalized relations within the framework of law. I see China stepping in more and more to play this role. It's a natural role for China to play. What they did with Saudi Arabia and Iran was very forward-looking, and not only in terms of the Middle East, but in terms of, again, let's just look at the expanded BRICS. You know, I think if we say that, you know, the world right now, the global economic engine is fueled by oil and gas, and it is. Let's look at the new BRICS. Russia, one of the largest oil producers in the world. Saudi Arabia, Iran, large, United Arab Emirates, large oil producers. India, China, huge oil consumers. You know, so in, you know, Brazil and South Africa, Ethiopia, developing nations that need access, you know, to energy. This is a relationship that becomes a, you know, it's self-contained. It's self-sustainable. It doesn't need the United States. It doesn't need Europe, and it's going to expand in that way too. You're going to attach people that consume energy, produce energy, and you have this symbiosis taking place. It's a beautiful thing to behold, especially if you're against American hegemony. You look at the American imperialists going, we don't like this because the world is developing and growing in a way that doesn't involve us. We're not in control. We're not profiting from this. And China is taking the lead in that. I think that's China's role. I don't think you can set an international table and not invite China. And look, that's what the United States has tried to do in the Pacific. If you look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership that failed, Donald Trump pulled out of it. It was all about setting an international table in the Pacific, but excluding China. It didn't work. China's now set a table that doesn't include the United States or Canada because they say, we don't want you. You're a disruptive force. I mean, the United States has become that mad uncle that you don't want coming to your table at Thanksgiving because you know he's going to come in here smelling of alcohol and he's going to swear at people and get sick and disrupt the whole meal. So it's like, no, we don't invite you anymore. We want a table full of people that want to enjoy each other's company. When the United States learns how to clean up and behave, maybe they'll invite us to the table. But until then, we're just going to be on the outside being that relative that everybody's ashamed of, because there's a lot to be ashamed of the United States today and how we behave on the global stage.
There is a moment in this interview, he's asking about BRICS and G7, who's in favor of BRICS, who's in favor of G7, and Putin comes to a conclusion that these are something like two parts of the human brain. Despite all of their differences, they have to work with each other to have a better future, to have a prosperous future. Do you see this coming to the US foreign policy? Is there any hope that they're changing their policy, considering cooperation and compromise?
No. There's no hope for the United States in the near future. We have a certain political and economic elite that are tied to the past. They don't want to divorce themselves from the past. In order to get to that point, you have to have people willing to cut ties with the past to say that we're no longer going to behave as if we are the global hegemon. We have to recognize, you know, the new reality, and we have to adapt to this new reality. Right now, we don't have people that are capable of doing that, especially here in a presidential election cycle. You know, Joe Biden can't say, everything I've stood for my entire life is wrong. Therefore, trust me to lead us into this bold new future where America is no longer the dominant power, that we're going to have to sit down and treat people as equals. You remember, we live in an America that still is overwhelmingly imbued with the USA, USA chest thumping, we're number one attitude. And I'm as proud, I'm proud to be an American. I love being an American. I wouldn't want to be anything else besides an American. But I've also traveled the world enough to know that we're not number one, especially think of the arrogance of that. I mean, you live in Brazil right now. Could you imagine if I came to Brazil and came off the airplane, every Brazilian I ran to, I went, USA, baby, number one, Brazil, quaint little country. Thank you very much. How are you little Brazilian people doing? The Brazilian people are going to go, you're an asshole, which is right. You know, well, that's how America relates with the world right now. We don't treat anybody with respect. When we get off the airplane, we're expecting everybody to bow before us and treat us as the Americans, you know, the exceptional nation, the indispensable nation. But I would imagine that Brazilians can go to sleep at night, not losing too much sleep, worrying about America. I think Brazil's a big country. They have their own problems. They have their own issues. And I don't think that the last thought for each Brazilian before the lights go out is, what does America think about us? I don't think Brazil really cares about America. I think the rest of the world is like that as well. Now, if America wants to interact with Brazil, maybe the Brazilians could go to bed at night saying, well, I wonder what the Americans want to talk about. I look forward to that conversation. But then they move on to the rest of America. The world doesn't gravitate around America. We're not the center of gravity around which everything, we're not the sun around which everything rotates. We're part of the people that rotate around this center of gravity called humanity. We're one of humanity. And until we recognize that, our policies won't reflect anything. We're going to continue to be trapped in the policies of the past. We have to purge from existence, and I don't mean violently, I'm just talking about politically, everybody who's linked to past practices, because past practices are founded in arrogance, and America has to stop being arrogant. We have to start being, you know, pragmatic, realistic. We need to understand our proper role. It's not a diminished role. It doesn't mean that we're a small nation. We're a great nation, and we deserve a seat at the table. But we come to the table as equals, not as the superior power. We don't get to dictate outcomes. We have to negotiate and engage in dialogue to get consensus-driven outcomes. We don't have political leadership capable of doing that right now, and we don't have anybody on the horizon capable of doing that. It's going to be a decades-long process before America is able to fundamentally reshape its foreign policy.
Recently, Lavrov said that if we're going to get a new member for the UN Security Council, we support a representative from Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Do you think that would be one of the steps that we can take toward this situation of having some sort of balance in the international relations?
Well, it's common sense. Of course it is. But, you know, what it shows you is the comfort level of Russia and its role in the world today. You know, Russia looks at the Security Council right now, the five permanent members, and they see the United States, Great Britain, France. Look at those three. Victors of the Second World War, but really only one's a great nation. France and Great Britain are just a joke, literal a joke. I mean, Great Britain, when you factor it into the list of nations, it's pathetic. It's at the bottom. France, same thing. These are not great nations. They're not even great civilizations anymore. France is holding on to some sort of claim, but there's nothing. The British Empire, a thing of the past. Great Britain, the Commonwealth, just a crumbling edifice of nothingness. Then you have Russia and China, and they're looking at each other going, we're doing okay. We're sort of confident in where we stand today. We got BRICS. We got the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Russia's got great relations with Africa. They don't fear Africa. Russia is capable of having good relations with South America. They don't fear Venezuela. They don't fear Brazil. They don't fear. They're comfortable with these people as equals. That's the thing. And the Chinese, they're just basically saying the whole world is our oyster, economic oyster. We'll deal with everybody. Bring more to the table. We can handle this because we're China. We have an economy that's growing, booming. We're comfortable with this. The United States isn't comfortable because right now we can control the Security Council because we can control these two little pathetic puppies that are there, France and the United Kingdom. If you bring in another Security Council member that, you know, there's talk of, you know, Germany, can, why would you let Germany in? A, they were defeated World War II power, so they should never be given a seat at the table, just like Japan. But even if they did come in, it's a failing economy. Why not bring in a thriving economy, a growing economy? You know, again, South Africa, you know, it's got a seat at the table in BRICS. Make South Africa a permanent Security Council member. That would be nice. In Asia, you can, you know, there's a lot of candidates. India, their power. Let's bring India in. Brazil deserves a seat at the table. They're there. But see, what I just gave you is I gave you three of the BRICS countries. It shows you that, you know, the United States is not in control of the growth of the world. It's not comfortable with a growing and empowered world. And the United States will not allow expansion of the Security Council in this manner. If they were going to agree to expansion, they would have to have a country they can control. The United States doesn't know how to coexist with people as equals. We have to control people. So we will not allow the expansion of the Security Council unless it includes Germany, Japan. We can control these two countries. But God, no, we're never going to let Brazil in. We're never going to let India in. We're never going to let South Africa in because we're afraid of them. We're afraid of truly independent-minded nations.
When it comes to the case of Navalny, the mainstream media went crazy about making stories. The way they were treating this case of Navalny and the case of Julian Assange and other cases that we had, how do you see this difference?
Well, first of all, don't ever insult Julian Assange by using his name in the same sentence with Navalny. Never. Navalny is a scum. He's a CIA asset. He's a Russian who betrayed his country, took CIA money for the sole purpose of carrying out an American plan of undermining Russia. He's not a Russian Democrat who rose up and said, I'm against Vladimir Putin and I will rally Russians together using the strength of my ideas to do this. No. You know, people say, well, that can't exist in Russia. I just ask people, when Vladimir Putin wins an election in Russia, what's the percentage of the vote that he gets? It's in the 60% range. That means that there's around 40% of Russians who don't support Vladimir Putin. Sounds like an opposition to me, doesn't it? I mean, it's a pretty empowered opposition, actually. Now, of that 40%, 22% of them are communists who have always opposed Vladimir Putin. The communists believe that they should be in power. Has Vladimir Putin shut down the Communist Party? Do you have Russian police kicking down the doors of Communist Party things, arresting people, taking them up? No. Nope. Why? Communist Party may be thinking they can do a better job than Putin, but never once did they say, we're willing to sell out Russia to do this. The Communist Party is the Russian Communist Party. They believe in Russia. So they're no threat to Russia. And a political threat to Putin is a political threat to Putin, a political, which we handled the way politics is always handled. You know, you put out better ideas. I mean, is there political gamesmanship in Russia? Of course there is, just like in the United States, just like anywhere else. But, you know, Putin doesn't shut down political opposition. People have to understand that. There is a strong political opposition. The problem is the West doesn't control the Communist Party. So therefore, we don't call them an opposition. We say they're a useful tool of Vladimir Putin. We only support an opposition if it does what we want to do, which is to destroy Russia, not to empower Russia, not to make Russia stronger. See, any genuine political opposition in Russia would say, I can do a better job than Vladimir Putin in terms of growing Russian interest, making Russia a stronger nation. But when you have a Navalny whose whole thing was, how can I destroy Putin? How can I destroy Russia? We know, I mean, it was, I think, 4 days before Navalny died. The man who is the consort of his wife gave a statement online who said, we're sort of powerless while Navalny's in prison. We need a miracle in prison. We need something to happen in prison to awaken us. I wonder what that would be. But then he said, once that happens, the first thing we're going to do is tear apart Russian oil and gas enterprises, Rosneft, Gazprom, tear them apart and sell them off to the West. Why? How does that strengthen Russia? It weakens Russia. So Navalny is scum, human scum, pawn scum. He's a nobody. He's a nobody in Russia. Nobody cares about him in Russia. Nobody's losing any. I mean, his mother does, some other people. I mean, it's only, you know, natural. But the bottom line is the vast majority of Navalny's political support, which never could manifest in more than 2 to 5% nationwide, by the way, and on his best day, they fled when the special military operation took place and when the mobilization took place. They fled. They ran away like the good, true Russian patriots they are. Cowardly scum. They ran away. And they're here in the West, and they're singing Navalny's praise. Navalny is a corrupt man. He was arrested and convicted on charges of corruption. Now, people say that they're politically motivated charges, but never once did you have somebody say he's innocent of the charges. There might be some political motivation. I mean, if I were the Russians looking at this CIA asset trying to keep coming in, trying to destroy Vladimir Putin, attacking him, taking CIA money to do things, there might be some political motivation to terminate him. But he made it easy. They terminate him by arresting him for the crimes he committed, he actually committed. And then you hold him account, you put him in prison. And then you hold him account for his extremism, his political extremism. Now, you and I might say, as a, you know, in America, those charges wouldn't fly in America because we have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. But I will say this, no. Because there are equivalents in America. What would we call an American citizen who takes Russian money for the express purpose of undermining constitutional authority? At a minimum, we would charge that person with a failure to register as a foreign agent. And we would arrest them, and we know we can put them in jail for many years for that. Just ask Paul Manafort. But at a maximum, we could charge them with treason because they're going against constitutional rule. So the idea that, you know, Russia's shutting down Navalny by, you know, hitting him with an extremist charge, that's, you know, that's part of the Russian, you know, no, we do it in the West. Of course we do it in the West. Hell, Germany arrests people just for, you know, thinking things about pro-Russian attitude. You know, you can't be pro-Russian in Germany, you go to jail. You can't say, they'll put you in jail. Is that democracy? No. The same thing with France, same thing with almost all of Europe. Navalny played a dangerous game. He made common cause with the CIA. And we're now learning, you know, at the same time Navalny was working the CIA to undermine Russia from within, the CIA was building bases in Ukraine to undermine Russia from without, to destroy Russia. So there should not be any doubt in anybody's mind who Alexei Navalny is. He is a traitor to Russia. He is human scum. He died the traitor's death. And in Russia, nobody cares. In the West, of course, we will glorify his name. We will plaster it all over the place. But at the end of the day, he will be forgotten. Why? Well, let me ask you this. Do you know the name Boris Nemtsov? He's a Russian opposition figure, big guy. He was the guy that actually could challenge Putin. He had, you know, he could generate 20-30%. He got assassinated in Moscow by some Chechens, and he's dead. You know, we shouted his name. We plastered all over Nemtsov, Nemtsov. Then it quietly went away because he doesn't matter anymore. He's dead, out of sight, out of mind. This time next year, let's see how many people are shouting Alexei Navalny's name. And in 5 years' time, I can guarantee you this. The vast majority of American kids going to colleges who are studying Russian won't even know his name because he's a nobody. He's a non-entity. He's scum. He's not somebody worthy of being remembered. So I don't lose too much sleep over Alexei Navalny, but I would also say please don't use his name in the same sentence as Julian Assange. Julian Assange didn't betray his country. Julian Assange stood up for free speech. Julian Assange exposed the war crimes of the United States. Julian Assange is a hero. Alexei Navalny is a traitor. They aren't the same people.
CIA Director William Burns, that was recently in Kiev. In your opinion, what was behind this trip? How important was this mission that he had to go there personally?
Well, I think what we're finding out is that the CIA has been at the center of this conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The CIA has been carrying out operations that use Ukraine to target Russia since 1948, 1949, nonstop. There's been no break in it. And we're finding out that, you know, according to the New York Times, that the CIA, in the aftermath of its the CIA-backed Maidan revolt and the coup in February of 2014, that the CIA worked with Ukrainian intelligence to build bases along the Ukrainian-Russian border for the sole purpose of attacking Russia, to undermine Russia from within. You know, and this is the very kind of NATO threat that Vladimir Putin was talking about when he said we had to preempt it. So the CIA director going to Ukraine is literally, it's more important than the president of the United States going to Ukraine, because the president of the United States makes politically meaningless statements. The CIA does practical things. And so the CIA right now is working with Ukraine to find a way to continue the CIA project of using Ukraine to undermine Russia in an atmosphere where American money has been cut off for the time being. So the CIA is looking for alternative ways of sustaining this this fight. This is the CIA's fight, straight up CIA operation. And again, we just have to keep this in mind that at the same time we're talking about this, the CIA was funding Alexei Navalny. So we know what Navalny was about. It wasn't about political reform. He was part of the CIA's master plan to take down Russia.
We know that Lula, president of Brazil, recently compared Israelis to Nazis. How valid are these comments from Lula?
Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal who presides over a genocidal state carrying out active genocide against the Gazan population. It's not speculation. The International Court of Justice has determined that what the Israelis are doing is genocide. So Lula's 100% correct. There's really nothing to talk about. Benjamin Netanyahu will go down in history as the Israeli equivalent of Adolf Hitler. One can only hope that there'll be a Nuremberg tribunal where Benjamin Netanyahu and his government are held accountable and hung by the neck until dead, because that's what they deserve. These are war criminals. They have perpetrated horrific crimes against humanity. And they don't deserve mercy. They don't deserve sympathy. They damn sure don't deserve any support. Israel is a criminal enterprise. It has become a criminal enterprise. If you don't understand that, then you really, your brain doesn't function. There's really no ifs, ands, or buts here. This is not a gray zone. There's nothing complicated about this at all. Israel is committing genocide. The world has determined that it's committing genocide. Israel doesn't care what the world thinks. Israel continues to commit genocide. They are murdering Palestinian women and children as we speak. Right now, as we speak, they're killing them. But nobody gives a damn, because apparently we're not allowed to think about Israel in that way. Thank God for the Brazilian president for calling a spade a spade.
Right now, they're trying to drag them to the northern part of Gaza. How do you see this policy? Why they're doing this?
It's genocide. They're trying to depopulate Gaza. They're going to do it by either killing them or driving them out of Gaza. It's genocide. Why do we ask questions? I'm not picking on you. You're doing your job. You're doing an interview. But I mean, these questions already have the answer. I mean, the only answer is Israel is a genocide state. It's committing genocide against the Palestinian people. That's it. There's no other explanation. Israel is the manifestation of evil. It's the modern day version of Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany. And the crimes that Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany perpetrated against the Jews are being perpetrated against the Palestinians today, in the open. In the open. And nobody's doing anything about it. You know, there was an American that immolated himself in front of the Israeli embassy the other day. And on his website, I think his name was Aaron. And on his website, he postulated a question, and I'll paraphrase it. But, you know, people ask themselves, what would I have done if I was alive during Nazi Germany? During the concentration camps, during apartheid, during, you know, this, that, and the other crimes, what would I have done? And he said, you're doing it. Sitting on your ass and doing nothing. Absolutely nothing. Israel's committing crimes, horrific crimes, genocide. And what are we doing? Not a damn thing. Not a damn thing. And everybody who listens to this podcast, just look in the mirror and ask yourself, what have you done? I mean, don't tell me you posted something on social media. What have you done? What are you doing? What would you do to stop this? If the answer is Nothing. At least be honest and say nothing. I won't do anything to stop it. And that doesn't make you evil. It makes you the same as everybody else in history that didn't do anything to stop an evil as it was manifesting itself right in front of your face. But at least don't call yourself an engaged citizen. Don't claim to be some sort of moral authority. You're nothing. You're nothing. You're just part of the sheep. And you'll suffer the fate of all sheep. You'll be led to the slaughterhouse. Your throats will be slit. Your carcasses will be hung. We'll take your skin and make clothing out of it. And we'll take your meat and we'll consume it. And you will be nothing, nothing. That's what you want to be, then so be it. But there's murder taking place right now. There's genocide taking place. Lula had the courage to call it out. He should be praised for this courage. Ireland is talking about sanctioning Israel. The entire world should be sanctioning Israel. Israel should no longer exist. It doesn't deserve the right to exist. I'm not talking about annihilating the Israeli people, but I'm saying that Israel has forfeited any legitimacy, just like Nazi Germany forfeited legitimacy. That doesn't mean we did away with Germany. Germany still exists, but it's not Nazi Germany. The Israeli people can continue to live in a homeland, but to say that we're going to allow this Zionist genocidal entity to continue to exist is absurd. I mean, if something emerges from this, it has to be a Palestinian homeland where Israelis can live side by side with the Palestinians if they so choose to. If they don't want to, then go back to the home of your origin. Go back to Poland, go back to Romania, go back to France, go back to Ukraine, go back to Russia, go back to where you came from, because you are not of the Middle East. You've come in like a cancer cell and you've metastasized. It's time for the international community to do the necessary surgery to remove this cancer from the Middle East and allow the Middle East to heal.
We know that the public opinion in the United States is mostly against supporting Netanyahu and his administration. But when are we going to have some sort of translation of this public opinion in the U.S. foreign policy, in your opinion?
Never. Never. Not as long as Israel buys the United States Congress and buys the American presidency, owns the American mainstream media. You know, this isn't anti-Semitic. I'm not against Jewish people. I am against Jewish people who align with Israel. Now I have a problem because Israel's a maniacal, genocidal nation that doesn't deserve to exist. If you call yourself an American Jew, that means you believe in America. You believe in our values. You believe in what we stand for. And you could never stand up for that. Just like an American Jew was against Nazi Germany, an American Jew should be against this evil Zionist genocidal entity called Israel. But they can't because they say, oh, no, but they're Jewish. No, not really. The vast majority of them are. I mean, and those who can, you know, claim, it's like we would say to America, the American Muslim community, just because Osama bin Laden perverted Islam and uses a case to attack, you know, innocents around the world, you're not guilty because you're Muslim. We don't sit there and say because you're Muslim, you automatically have to identify with that. As an American Jew, you don't automatically have to identify with this genocidal entity called Israel. It's not a Jewish state. It doesn't reflect your values. It reflects evil, pure evil. But we have allowed them to come in, them, not Jews, them, Israel, the Zionist entity, to come in and buy our Congress. They have an organization, the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which in its previous manifestation was singled out by the United States government. I believe it was JFK, who said you have to register as a foreign agent because you're doing Israel's bidding. So they renamed themselves, and then they went in and they bought people off under the scenes, and now they don't have to be registered. But they have put $100 million on the table, $100 million to buy Congress in the 2024 election. I'm not making this up. They brag about it, how they're going to buy Congress. Benjamin Netanyahu brags about how easily it is to control America because Israel owns us. They own our president. They own our Congress. They own our mass media. You can't talk bad about Israel. Do you really hear any anti-Israeli? I mean, the reason why I say anti-Israeli is this. We do hear anti-Russian voices on mainstream media all the time. And Russia doesn't deserve that. But Israel does deserve to have people opposing it stand. I'm not saying that you can't bring people on to have a debate about it. That's fair. But they don't allow that to happen. They just buy into the Israeli narrative, which is premised on lies. They turn a blind eye to the genocide. So until we can purge this cancer from America, because it is a cancer, it's destroying America. It's destroying us. We're allowing it to destroy us. Until we purge it and we emerge as truly an American entity reflective of American values set forth in the Constitution of the United States, and not an America that is controlled by a Zionist entity that uses America as a shield to protect them from the genocidal acts that they are perpetrating, there won't be any changes, none whatsoever.
In Israel right now, we are having huge clashes in Tel Aviv against the government. Is that possible that we see some sort of changing in the Israel domestic policy that would influence their policy on Gaza and on every issue that we're witnessing right now?
No, I think we're seeing a lot of anger against Benjamin Netanyahu and his government because they got Israel into this war. They weren't ready on October 7th, and they're not freeing the hostages, and they're doing things. But the truth is, if they overthrow Benjamin Netanyahu today, it's not going to change their mindset about Palestinians. Israel is an evil entity where the ingrained hatred, Israel understands that it cannot exist if it allows a Palestinian state to exist. That Israel's duty to survive is to suppress and eliminate the potential of a Palestinian state. And whether Netanyahu's pushed out or stays in, that's not going to change. There is not a political center of gravity in Israel that says we need to learn how to live in peace with the Palestinians. There's no support, mainstream support in Israel for a two-state solution, let alone a one-state solution, unless the one-state solution is a Jewish homeland for the Jews from the river to the sea. So no, I don't see any chance of Israel reforming from within. Israel is a broken nation, a corrupt nation, a criminal nation, and the only solution to this Israeli, abomination that exists is the elimination of Israel, and the incorporation of whatever Jewish population in Palestine that wants to stay there and can live in peace with Palestinian people, incorporate them with the Palestinian people into a singular entity called Palestine. Anything less than that is a recipe for defeat and disaster.
As a consequence of this conflict in Gaza, we have the conflict in the Red Sea. How do you see the operation that United States together with the United Kingdom is doing right now in the Red Sea? How long they can stay there, in your opinion?
The Houthis have been bombed since 2014 by American airplanes dropping American bombs. They don't give a damn about what the United States and the United Kingdom are doing. They don't. What they are doing is sinking ships. What they are doing is cutting communication cables. What they are doing is having a meaningful impact on the region and the world. And no American bomb is going to change this. And the United States is recognizing this. It only makes us look weak. It only makes us look weak. The only way out of this is for the United States to bring about a ceasefire, allow humanitarian goods to come in, and begin a process that will result in a Palestinian state. At that time, the Houthi will no longer have justification to continue their actions. But until that time, the Houthi will do what the Houthi do.
When it comes to the solution of this conflict, we know that Europeans are considering two-state solution. Do you think they're honest in their solution?
Neither Europe nor the United States is honest in anything they do with regard to Israel, because they're all controlled by Israel. The Europeans less so than the United States, but for instance, Germany is a European nation. They will never allow a European consensus to form around a truly independent Palestinian state. Germany will forever be the apologist of Zionist Israel. So no, I don't trust but again, they don't matter. I mean, what is Europe doing to help solve this problem besides providing political cover for Israel? The only way that Europe could have an impact on this is if they decided to sanction Israel, to strangle Israel to death if Israel doesn't change its policies, to have some leverage over Israel. Because otherwise, Israel's not going to change the way it's doing. If Israel doesn't feel threatened by Europe, then Israel doesn't care. Israel is telling the whole world, we don't care about you. You don't matter. We are the only ones that matter. And so Europe is irrelevant.